Hey, I'm Eric Lefuge from fitnessbusinessinterviews.com, and today I'm here with the guru himself, and it's coming from across the pond in London, and that is Mr. Dax Mullane. I was thinking of all kinds of cool intros that I could do for Dax and start listing off all the major accomplishments that he's got, but I'd be here for a half hour doing that. So I'm going to just simplify it and say that Dax is the guru's guru, and he's here today to talk and discuss about how you can become a guru and why passion and purpose are so important to what you're doing. So, Dax, thanks so much for being here, man. I appreciate it.
Ah, thanks for having me here. You know me. Whenever I'm given a platform for my mad ramblings, I'm always happy.
but they're always very good ramblings, though. I'm always learning a lot of stuff from you, and that's why I'm glad to get you on to share that with everybody. All right, so one of the things I want to do, just to dive in, if people don't know who you are, they call you the highest paid personal trainer in the world. That's a title. What's the highest price package that you offer or that you've offered?
$25,000 a week for one person. So okay. It's, as far as I'm aware, that's not a moniker I've taken myself. Other people have called me that, but you know, it's certainly been reported in the various magazines that I've been featured in, like Grazia and so on and so forth. They call me that too. So, it's a very high end program where I take clients out of their day-to-day lives. We take them away to kind of luxury accommodation in places like Thailand, and we do a complete life remodel. So, you know, mind, body, and spirit, and kind of, you know, a lot of work inside the head.
All right, now, a lot of people who are going to see this, listen to this, and see the notes on this, they're going to be thinking, $25,000 a week, that's insane. So, and they're probably asking, when you offer something like this to people, do they actually hesitate when you tell them how much it costs?
No. I mean, that partly because the kind of people that I attract to this particular program, they're the kind of people, A, with that sort of money. Obviously, you're not going to, if you're only earning $30,000 a year, you're not going to go on a $25,000 a week program. Right. So they generally tend to be very wealthy in the first place. So to date, I've taken CEOs, royalty, pop stars, kind of lots of people that, yes, you know, right. Genuinely very wealthy people. But also there's that element of belief that the kind of thing that I promise is going to happen, because this isn't just a workout. This isn't me taking them away to help them lose 10 pounds. You know, this is a life remodel. This is getting inside their head. And so the feedback that I've been given is they would expect something like that to be of high, a high ticket item. I think they'd be very suspicious if I said you could do it for, you know, $1,500.
Right. Based on the clientele that you're attracting to that. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, you obviously didn't start out this way. You know, you didn't start out charging 25 grand a week or being able to do that. You've been at this for a while now. So again, for people who aren't too familiar with your story or what you are, can you just give a brief background of kind of how you got to that point to be able to charge and run those kinds of programs?
Yeah, I mean, the whistle stop tour is I started out in the forces, and when I left the forces, I was looking for, at the time, to be honest, I was just looking for interesting paid work. It wasn't ever on the cards I was going to become a fitness professional. And I did some time as a bodyguard, which I didn't like. You know, I found it really boring. I'd worked on some building sites. I'd done everything from road sweeper to you name it. And I wasn't earning very much money, and B, I wasn't enjoying life very much. I found that, you know, I'd ultimately left the forces because it's a hard life when you've got children. I've got quite a big family. I'd left, but I was hoping to find something that was going to really inspire and motivate me and keep me turned on to life as I went forward. And what I found was I was actually getting turned off. I was finding life quite hard. I was finding that I was unfocused, that all the things that I really valued from being a soldier weren't present in civilian life for me at the time. Right. And so, you know, I started to kind of dig down deep a bit and kind of say, well, okay, if you're not going to be a soldier, what are the things that you have always been consistently happy with, things that you always consistently approached that always made you feel a bit, you know, a bit more you, a bit more like you were kind of doing what you were here to do. And I was able to trace back that, you know, I started boxing at age 12. I was a very good boxer. I competed at a very high standard, went on to kind of win national championships and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I was always into fitness. Then I joined the forces and went for some pretty tough regiments like Airborne and Commando and stuff like this. So I knew that fitness was always an important part. And even while I was struggling financially, I was still doing my training. I was still doing circuit training and running and everything else. So, you know, something or someone must have hit me upside the head with the idea of becoming a trainer. So I scrounged up the very last of the money that we had in the bank account, which wasn't very much. It was about £325 sitting in the family bank account. And it just so happened to be the exact amount to do a gym instructor's course. So I paid this money across, did the gym instructor's course, attended it for 2 weeks, passed with flying colors, and then came back and tried to get a job. And the only job going at my local gyms were they were doing the kind of like the graveyard shift of gym inductions, you know, kind of the equivalent of anyway. There was the 6 and 7 a.m. on a Saturday morning, so 2 hours a week. And they were only paying £5 an hour for that. So 2 hours a week, £5 an hour. And I jumped at it. I took it. You know, kind of did it. So I was at this £10 a week job, but I was really pleased because I was getting to do something that I enjoyed doing. And I essentially lived in that gym. I was being paid for 2 hours, but I lived there for about 40 or 50 hours a week, essentially. I helped every member I could. I showed them stuff that no one else was showing them. You know, even the personal trainers there weren't really working the floor or talking to people. They were only interested in people if they were paying. So I did this and eventually got accepted to be a personal trainer at that gym. And, you know, I did several other things. I was a GP referral consultant for several years. I became the senior consultant in my own center and advised the British government on setting up the GP referral schemes. And I very quickly became very popular, got to the point where I was doing 60 appointments a week as a personal trainer. So I wasn't working 60 hours a week. I was doing 60 appointments per week. And I did that for a whole year and managed to save a whole bunch of money. And then I got screwed over by the gym that I worked at. I hit them with some really great ideas about how they could market because they'd never seen someone like me who'd done so well and was making so much money. And so, you know, they approached me and said, how do you do this? So I wrote a marketing plan, a business plan and everything else. And they basically screwed me over. They had my plans and I told them how to do it. And they said, oh, thanks very much. And by the way, we're not promoting you to a management position. We're going to run your ideas, but you don't have a degree. So you can't be a manager. So I decided to quit and I opened my own place and essentially haven't looked back since. I've been, you know, voted one of the UK's top personal trainers. I opened up my own studios. I opened up a training academy that taught trainers how to do the stuff that I was doing, which was very different to the mainstream and still is. And then I also kind of extended into mentoring personal trainers and teaching them how to make money from their passions. At the time, I think there are some guys who are very close to me in fees of that program now. But, you know, when I first started, I was the most expensive coach of coaches in the world at the time. It was $10,000 per student to enter my coaching program. Mm-hmm. So I have this history of setting the benchmarks quite high in pretty much every area of my life and expecting to be paid very well for things that I do now. But at the same time, as most people were, you know, as you know, and as many people know, excuse me, I'm knocking my laptop all over the place. I also do a heck of a lot. I still do. I always have. I've built my business on the concept of free. I still do a lot for free. But that stuff that I charge for, I expect to be paid extremely well for. So I'm now the highest paid trainer in the UK by the hour. I'm £200 an hour. And the $25,000 a week program and the $10,000 a year mentoring and all the rest of it. I only bring all that up because you mentioned kind of the background fees and stuff. And I guess it's interesting to some people, but, the money is less important to me than certainly now that I've got some, it's far less important to me than it used to be as a driver. And I don't suggest that people make their income their primary measurement of them being successful or not, because, you know, I think you're probably going to ask me about it at some point anyway. Yeah. But, you know, there was a period in my career where I lost my way and I got very money focused and everything went really wrong for me. So, you know, you focus on the cash and you generally tend to really negatively impact upon who you are and what you're trying to be anyway.
Yeah, and this is something we've talked about a couple of times now, and interesting topic. And what I want to do is I want to shift gears a little bit, because, you know, you gave your background information, how you started out to how you're able to charge what you're charging now, and you got the following and the respect with it. I want to talk about being a guru. Did a presentation on this recently. Outstanding presentation, very, very eye-opening to not just me, but to a lot of people who saw it. Ask you a couple questions about this. So first off, you're a guru, right?
I am indeed, yeah. I'm proud to say it. I mean, most people talk about guruism being, you know, very tongue-in-cheek and usually in some defamatory way, you know, kind of they're normally to coin an English expression, they're normally taking the piss, right? You know, kind of. So someone said, oh, you know, guru Dax Moy said, right? And they don't normally mean it in a good way. When I use the term guru, I mean it very specifically. And guru actually comes from the Sanskrit, kind of two words, gu meaning darkness and ru meaning light. So if you're a guru, you're a person who leads someone from the darkness and into the light, which in Asian society, still to this day, if you get the prefix guru before your name, and you're held in extremely high esteem in society, and you're deemed to be a very important person because you're shown to be essentially a teacher, someone who's showing people how to get out of the crap that they're in and find a way to do better for themselves. It just so happens in Western society, we denigrate that term, we put it down, and we deem it to be something negative. But yeah, I'm a guru, and I say it proudly. Yeah.
Would you consider me a guru?
Absolutely. In fact, I would consider every single person on the planet a guru in some way, shape, or form. Now, so this differs massively, as you'll remember from the talk, to the concept of leader, because when you're a leader, you generally tend to want to get up on a stage, and you put yourself at the pinnacle of the pyramid, and everyone else are your kind of they're your underlings. They're various levels of subserviency and follower. Right. Now, the problem with that is that it puts you into this perpetual mindset of effectively considering yourself to be better than other people. Now, guruism isn't about that. Guruism recognizes that whilst I can be shining the light on something that you're in the dark about today, you can equally turn back around and say, Dax, and I noticed that you were struggling with this. Let me shine the light on that for you. So the concept of guruism is one that's much more interdependent rather than hierarchical. So a leader generally tends to be a very hierarchical model. And it's just very interesting that, again, particularly in Western society, we place a lot of value on leaders. We say, you've got to demonstrate leadership. You know, in other words, you have to get people to follow you. We judge your value in life by how many people you can have following you. And we even see that in our social media. You know, how many followers have you got?
Right?
Kind of followers stroke friends. You know, we kind of effectively, you know, we're looking for who's got the biggest list of people. You know, I have 2,764 people follow me. Oh, damn. I only have 400. And therefore the person with the 400 is in some way deemed to be inferior to the other.
Right.
But guruism is very, very different, because guruism is saying that I can be a guru to my 9-year-old son, my 11-year-old son, when I go downstairs and I show him, forgotten how many sons I've got. I can be a guru to him when I go downstairs and show him how to do something with his math. But he can be a guru right back to me in the very next second by showing me how he's, we've gone old school. He's just got a brand new Rubik's Cube, right? Kind of after all the around when I was a kid, he's got a Rubik's Cube today. Well, he can guru me on how to get through the Rubik's Cube, which kids are really good at. So this is the point. We are all in the dark about something. And when you truly go through life trying to be the guru, or not just trying, but determining that you are going to be the guru, you're going to be someone who seeks out people that are in the dark, and you shine the light for them, you can and do change lives, and you change them dramatically. And so this is the model that I've been using for quite some time now, is that I decided that I was going to get away from being a leader, because actually huge parts of being a leader made me really unhappy. Mm-hmm. And they made me very grabby, you know, kind of money grabby, and they made me very, I guess the only word to describe it is fearful. I was, you know, even though I felt I was in pole position, I was always looking over my shoulder to see if there was anyone catching up to me and anyone who was about to take my market share. And I'd be very worried about, Eric's got a big following of personal trainers at the moment. They seem to be really liking his stuff. Does that mean they don't like mine anymore? Does that mean that, if I've got something to sell, then, and Eric's speaking to the same group of people that I am, well, you know, has he trumped my chances of making that sale? And I really didn't like who I was becoming as a result of that. I was becoming extremely fearful, and an exhibition of that fear was often aggression, you know, kind of. And it, yeah. Again, we see that in leadership based thinking, is that we have to smash our competitors, right? And even that concept of competitors, the way I think now is, you and I aren't competitors at all, and yet you may be going after some of the exact same people that I'm going after in terms of the people I'm trying to attract and help. And eventually, because I'm still a businessman, even though I'm a guru, yes, mm-hmm. I want to make money from, you know, I'm hoping that all the people listening to this call one day will spend some money with Dax Moy. That'd be great.
Of course.
But it doesn't have to come from a competitive place. It doesn't have to come from a place where you and I are racing each other to get those bucks from those people's wallets before each other.
Right.
I've got to get there before Eric.
Right.
You know, and that might become prevalent in me. And I was noticing in a lot of people as well, a lot of people around me, the language on blogs talking about being a leader and competing and, you know, knock your competition out the water. And, you know, it just didn't suit me. It didn't suit who I wanted to become. And in fact, it was turning me into someone that I knew damn well I didn't want to become.
Was this that phase too, where you were like, you know, you were really focused more on the money?
Oh yeah. I mean, it happened probably about 8 or 9 years ago for me now, where I was starting to believe some of my own hype, right? I'd gotten my own studios. I'd been in the newspapers a lot. I'd been on TV. I've been voted one of the UK's top trainers and all this kind of stuff. And I started to believe my own hype. I started to believe in the Dax Moy, you know, the kind of the press version of Dax Moy.
Right.
And I became very, very greedy. I became very focused on, like, you know, right now, there's no money being made out of this telephone call, right? This talk that we're having right now. There's no, you know, there's no nothing either up front or in the background. We're not doing this to monetize it. Well, 9 years ago, you would have asked me, you know, to do this call, and I would have point blanks kind of asked you, well, you know, okay, what are we going to do to make sure that something gets sold here? Are you going to promote my product? Are you going to tell people about it? You know, or do you have a product that I can promote that I can get affiliate income off of? And if that wasn't there, I would have said no to you. I've got something better to do with my hour than to sit on a call with you, Eric. Sorry. I may not have said it point blank as that, but that would have been the conversation in my head, that there would have been no financial return, so why bother?
And what did this do to you, like, just being in this way?
I'm sorry?
So what did this do to you in being in this mindset? Like, what did this ultimately lead to?
Ultimately, it created detachment. I literally woke up one morning, about, you know, 8.5, 9 years ago, and looked in the mirror and just thought, who the hell is this guy? Right. I was moving towards self-loathing. I didn't like the guy. This guy kept turning up in places and this absolute shit kept coming out of his mouth. And, you know, he was really pretentious and, you know, really into how well he was doing. All of his conversations were focused around him. Look at me. I'm doing really great. And, you know, if you and I were having a conversation and you tried to turn the conversation to you for a moment, I'd wrestle you back for your attention back on me. And that's who I became.
Right.
And I couldn't stand the guy. And, you know, I pretty much decided one day that I was, you know, that's it. I'm going to kill him. I don't like who this guy is. You know, he's not anything right. that I want to be. And I just made the decision then and there that version of me had to die. That one had to go, and that somebody knew how to take his place. And that's what I've worked at ever since.
Was there any instance or anything that made you realize that? Was there like one defining moment, or was it just a culmination of a bunch of things and you started to realize, yeah, this isn't really who I want to be?
Yeah. I mean, it was a whole bunch of things. It was from, friendships not going the right way, you know, kind of connectedness with my family not being the way it was. We're kind of, you know, strangers under the same roof essentially for a period, you know. So mm-hmm. all of these kind of things that were, you know, they're all big, like neon lighted fingers, like pointing and saying something is wrong,
yeah.
right?
Okay.
But I missed them for so long. And then, but it was kind of like one day I woke up and I could see every single neon finger pointing and saying something is wrong and it's you.
All right. Well, you realize that, and I'm glad that you did, because we wouldn't be here talking, you know, I wouldn't have been able to finally meet you. back at Sam's event. All these things have changed, and that's why we're here now. And what I want to do is I want to dive back into the guru thing. We were talking about it. You're a guru. The definition that you described it as is perfect, because I never thought of myself as a guru in any way until we had spoken. I had seen you speak, and I was like, okay, now I get it. And you basically describe it. But there's three types that you had discussed. Can you break those down, which type they are and what they mean?
Yeah, the first one is essentially, I mean, we don't necessarily have to do them. There's not a set order. So, you know, one of them is the transformative guru. Okay. So the transformative guru is ultimately the kind of guru that is demonstrating in both themselves and others how to create the transformation that people are seeking. Right. So, you know, good examples of that may be that, you know, I mean, look, one of the problems with personal trainers is that we have this tendency to think that we have to be doing everything perfectly right from the outset. Right. And that if we're able to show people that, if we're able to show people that we're less than perfect, that somehow they won't love us anymore. And yet, you know, if we were to actually take the time and we were to actually demonstrate some of our own transformations in ourselves, we were to say, well, hold on, you know, I'm a bit out of shape at the moment. You know, I don't know how this has happened, but I've ended up as this out of shape guy. And I really, you know, I'm really determined to do something about it. And you share that with people. You share the transformation. You are guruing by very definition. You're guruing. You're saying, look, I was in the dark and now I'm moving myself back to the light. And while I'm taking that journey, you know, I'm aware that many of you people may also be in the dark, and I'm going to show you how I'm doing it. Right. So it's transformation. We can teach that transformation in lots of different ways. Right. But that's just one example. When we run a, you know, again, as fitness professionals, when we run a transformation challenge, that we're doing exactly that. We're actually teaching people the exact process to go through. Right. So we've got this transformative guru, which is, I don't think enough people do enough with that area. And what I mean is they don't do enough in showing how they themselves was transformed. But this, at the moment, I'm demonstrating to you the kind of the transformative concept by telling you how far my life went in the wrong direction and how I pulled it back. Okay. So that is an example of being a transformative guru. And, you know, what we're doing on this call is actually sharing ideas on how others could actually, you know, if they feel they need to transform, how they could do that, right? So that's just one method of guruing. Another method of guruing is becoming the informative guru. So if you're an informative guru, you do things, ultimately you do things to share information that people are lacking, that's keeping them in the dark. So at the moment, you know, I may be in the dark about something really technical, or about something to do with, you know, I mean, you've become really, really great at securing people for these interviews, for example, right? You've made an art out of it. You know, you're doing a very, very good job of showing people how you can pretty much color anyone on telephone call and get them to tell you all their deepest, darkest secrets. Right? You're doing a really good job of that. So, you know, you could be my guru in that, because I could be saying to you, well, Eric, you know, I have no idea how to do this. Could you give me the information that I require? You know, I'm thinking of doing the exact same thing. I want to contact some people, but my experience has always been that they told me to get lost. How are you doing it? And you could be sharing solutions in that way. So an informative guru is someone who researches the solutions to problems and shares the findings. So this can be based upon your own experience, but it can also be based upon simply, you know, I'll just kind of backtrack a bit here. A lot of people think that a guru has to have been purely the transformative. They must have experienced the thing themselves. Otherwise, they've got no right to share it. Well, if you've read a really good book, if you read a really great book, you weren't the author of that book, and you know, you're not responsible for all the great news that's inside of that book, but you can be an informative guru to me, just like I was today when I posted my list of my 7 top spiritual books, right? Mm-hmm. So that was me playing the role of an informative guru. I didn't write those books. I didn't create the content. I have no say over what's in them or anything else. But I shared the information. I said, I've come across these great books that have really meant a lot to me and have really, really made a big difference in my life. And I would like you to check them out. Well, that's another example of being the informative guru, right? So, that's another example of it. And any time that you're sharing information that is either stuff that you have personal experience of, or stuff that you have come across in terms of other experts, you know, because this is an area where we generally tend to be very weak, because we so badly want to be seen as the expert. We don't want to screw things up by letting people know that, Dax Moyer wrote this. I'm doing something very similar, because we're working in very similar genre with some of our achievement material, right? But so it'd be very easy from the competitive or leadership mindset to get into this concept of, well, I don't want to put Dax up on a pedestal here because it's going to make me seem lower than I am. So we hold back on the information that could help people. The whole guru concept is a very, very different one, because the guru one says, it doesn't matter where the light comes from, I'm going to shine it anyway. Right? So that changes things, and that changes it for me, because I don't always have to be the guy who is the source of the light, right? The guy over there can have the light, and I can just say, well, you know, and a good example of that is with books or with somebody else's coaching program. And I can say, well, I think this guy over here has got the perfect source of light for your problem. You know, go to him and he'll shine the light on it. He'll shine that light on the darkness for you.
Right.
Okay, so informative guru is important. So if we look at that, we've got informative, who is someone who researches the solutions to problems and shares those findings. The transformative is usually someone with a proven track record of helping other people achieve their goals, or, you know, kind of solve their problems. And then you've got the demonstrative. So the demonstrative is someone who's gotten good results or is in the process of working towards similar results as their audience. So
right.
I did a hybrid of demonstrative and transformative. So just to kind of separate them out a little bit, a demonstrative guru, that's, you know, me, I've gotten fat and I'm going to get back into shape and you can share my journey. Or, I've made a six figures over the last kind of 6 months by doing these things. Follow me along on my journey as I show you how to get there. The transformative generally tends to be someone who's helping others get those results already, and you shine the spotlight on those guys, and you say, well, look, you know, look at all these guys that are getting the results that you're trying to get. Okay. So now, as you can see, all of these elements are actually already present in marketing. Right, we're already doing that. We're using case studies and testimonials, but it's the spirit in with which you do it that changes you from being a leader to a guru. When you're doing it solely to make the sale, you're marketing. You're saying, well, hold on, let me tell the story of Joe who lost 20 pounds, right? Well, why are you doing it? You know, and I'll be brutally honest here. There are some days where Dax Moyer the marketer is online, and there are some days where Dax Moyer the guru is online. Right. Mm-hmm. I still need to kind of have people attracted to the stuff that I'm doing. But it just so happens that the more you can focus on guruing, the more people pay attention to your marketing. It's just what I found. If I've spent a lot of time being the guru to you, being a demonstrative guru, showing the results I'm getting in my life, and even not just showing you the results I'm getting in my life, showing you the problems I'm having in my life, that's demonstrative too. One of the guys, I just finished a coaching call literally before we got onto this call. And one of the things that we discussed was that what's generally lacking in the fitness profession and in marketing in general is humanity. We've dehumanized ourselves.
Yep.
Okay. And so a big part of reconnecting with people is not showing them your stories of success. Look at me driving my big car and all the fancy holidays I take and the big house I live in and the six-figure income I've made, or the seven-figure. But actually, we connect with people initially over our stories of struggle.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's our story of struggle that initially makes us go, there's a lot of stuff that Dax Moyer is saying here that really sounds like me, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just that he's maybe a year or two ahead of where I'm at, or maybe I'm a little bit further, who knows. But, you know, he's a little bit further along the same path that I find myself on at the moment. And because of his story of struggle, I believe that he's the kind of guy who could help me. Right? Most fitness professionals generally tend to do the wrong thing, I believe. And I don't believe in absolute right and wrong, but kind of from the perspective of what their stated aim is, what their outcome is. If their outcome is to truly help people, they generally tend to be going about it the wrong way, because they generally tend to go through using their story of success, trying to use their story of success right. as the hook. People are think of Oprah, right?
Yeah.
You watch Oprah. Oprah is engineered around stories of struggle, right? Where, and yes, you eventually get to the story of success, but the thing that connects you and the thing that makes the audience's heart bleed for the person who's being interviewed is their story of struggle. And everyone in the audience sits there with tears, and they really connect with that person emotionally. It's like, wow, we really get you. We really understand you. They understand each other because of the struggles. And it's our struggles that make us human. When you remove the struggles, when you move to that point of only talking about your stories of successes, you create a very, very wide chasm between you and the person that you're communicating with. Because now you look like you're over there and they feel like they're over here. Mm-hmm. And like, well, you know, there's a huge gulf. How am I ever going to get there? So I think it's a big mistake that fitness professionals and marketers in general generally tend to make in going on about how many great successes they've had, and look at me with all my money, and look at me with all my cars and my vacations and everything else. The story of the struggle must really be present. And I don't just mean it from a marketing perspective, the story of the struggle. I mean in all of your communications, like everything you put out there, like talk to people about, you know, if you're being demonstrative and transformative, especially if you're being those two forms of guru, then people will connect with you far faster if the story of struggle is present. Doesn't necessarily have to be there as much in the informative version, because you're simply sharing, but it could be. You could be saying, you know, this is a book that really got me out of the pits of despair, you know, right. kind of, so I'm sharing right. this information. But the story of struggle generally tends to be more prevalent in the first two kinds of guru.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've found that, you know, I was thinking the exact way when I first started, just like that. It's all about success. Talk about the cool things that people are going to connect with you on, but it's not. It's the story.
No.
It's about, because everybody's got a story. Everybody's got some struggles that they had to overcome, and that's really what people resonate with.
And that's an indication of our humanity. If you take out the struggle component, the humanity disappears.
Yeah.
And being a great guru is being as real and genuine a human as you can possibly be, warts and all.
Right.
You know, you say to people, this is where I'm screwing, you know, this is where I'm still screwing up. You know, you see me as a success. Well, I feel like I've screwed up in these areas, and being honest about it, and being comfortable enough in your own skin to be able to point out the warts, you know, and again, that only serves to endear people to you all the more. It doesn't repel them.
You're listening to an exclusive interview on Fitness Business Interviews. To hear more interviews like this, visit www.fitnessbusinessinterviews.com.
Yeah, and I really hope that the people who are watching or listening to this are really understanding this, because this, when I first heard you talk about this, this was a huge mindset shift for me and for a lot of other people. So this is really important stuff that we're talking about. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you, because we talked about being guru and how it's actually really a good thing compared to like that negative thought, you know, process that they have towards what it is here in a Western society. But with it being so good, are there any downsides to being a guru?
Well, you know, there can be if it's this very strange thing, I guess, in some respects. You need to really bring it in terms of passion, right? You've got to bring your passion to the fore. But, you know, you gave a really good talk after mine, and you covered an area that I hadn't gotten to in my talk, although which underpins everything that I do as a guru. And that's, you must have a purpose,
mm-hmm.
right? If you try to guru purely off your passions, there's a real danger of getting burnt out, because the passionate guru, generally tends to be the one who, if he can't shine the light for other people, he has a tendency to try to carry their burdens for them, right? He or she starts to be the person who says, well, you know, if they can't do it, I'll do it for them. And if they're struggling with this and they can't get to the solution based upon what I'm telling them, then it now becomes my responsibility. Okay. And for a period, my version of guru was that guy. I felt that I was responsible for the success and failure of everyone I was mentoring and coaching. And, you know, weirdly enough, it became a huge burden for me. Right. So the idea of getting people out of darkness actually started to push me into it, because I was starting to say, am I really making a difference here? And I was spending a lot of time doubting myself. Once I shifted things on to actually being a guru, a purpose-focused guru, as opposed to purely a passion-focused one, things changed, and they changed quite dramatically, because I could realize that I could still really be on my purpose, but I didn't have to be the guy who carried everyone's baggage for them. Right? I can, you know, if my purpose is to have a major definite impact on the lives of every person I come into contact with, and I honestly and sincerely do that in every engagement I have across the course of the day, doesn't mean I succeed. It means that I'm trying to have that impact. And, you know, but the guy who cuts me up at the traffic lights, who gets the finger later on, he may say, I'm the same as everyone else. I'm not trying to say that if I live a perfect life. I get angry with things, I get pissed off with things. But I'm right. That's the guy that I'm trying to be, and I find myself most of the time being that guy. Okay. But in doing that, it's really, really important that I'm living my life with purpose. That I'm not getting caught up solely in my passions, because we all talk about passions, and even in finding the G spot, I spoke to people about, you know, you've got to be clear about your passions. Your passions should be present there, and I truly and honestly do believe that they should be. It's still an important part of the whole G spot concept.
Can you dive into that a little bit? For people who watch and don't know what that is.
But basically, what we call the G spot, or the guru spot, and this is ultimately the crossover. If you imagine a Venn diagram, it's the crossover of the things that you're most passionate about, the things that you're best at, and the things that will bring you the biggest return on investment. And that doesn't necessarily have to mean money, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it can do, and hopefully it does, because I want everyone to be paid lots and lots of money during the course of their lifetime. Money does generally tend to make your life better if you use it as a tool it's supposed to be. But ultimately, you know, we're looking at that crossover. When you find that thing that gives you the biggest return on your passion, the biggest return on your investment of, you know, whether that be money or time or anything else, and the thing that you're best at, that crossover area generally tends to be called your G-spot. And that G-spot is the thing that will generally tend to make you generally tend to give you the most passionate, purposeful, and powerful life that you could imagine. Mm-hmm. And we'll also give you a lot of financial return at the same time, even without making finances your ultimate goal. So, you know, but underlying that whole thing, like that, you know, if there was a G spot to the G spot, that would also include purpose, and it because that's extremely important. We all have passions. We all had passions in our life. You know, the first girlfriend or boyfriend you had, and you swore that there'd never be another, and she or he was the most person, right?
Right.
And yet, still in your life, you know, 15, 20 years later, the team that you used to play for in high school that was your everything, it was so important to you, do you still feel exactly the same way about that team? Probably not. You know, your first car or your first pet, or what, you know, just these passions that you had that were so important. And passions can and do fade over time. It's natural they do. Yeah. Once you find your purpose, however, that never leaves you. In fact, purpose generally tends to only get stronger over time. Once you find it, you generally tend to get more and more and more and more clarity alongside of it. Passion can come and go. This year it's horse riding, and next minute it might be mountain biking. You know, kind of they do come and go. So, you know, what we're really looking for as a true guru is for you to be working within your passions. And when you're working within your purpose, things can and do change quite dramatically.
What about someone who hasn't found their purpose yet? How important are their passions?
Well, your passions are extremely critical on the path to your purpose, because they generally tend to act like beacons, right? The things that you can get passionate about generally tend to be waypoints and markers. And if you follow them long enough, you will find, you know, for example, look, I came out of the forces. I was extremely passionate and purposeful about being a soldier. I was very clear on what I was doing there. When I became a civilian, I had no passions, and I'd lost the biggest purpose in my life to that point, other than my family. I'd kind of lost my way. Interestingly enough, it was when I paid attention to things that I'd been passionate about in the past. Well, boxing, you love that. being a soldier, well, what was a lot of your enjoyment there? It was the physical life. You know, these passions when they are lined up, they lined up like the North Needle on the compass, and they show me, well, get into something. You know, I wasn't certain that, you know, I'd be lying if I said that when I got into fitness that I knew that it was going to become this important to me and that I would be using it as the platform that I now use it for. I didn't have a clue, but I just knew that I was passionate about it. And if you follow your passions down the trail for long enough, they'll generally start to point you in the direction of your purpose. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very, very rarely the case that doesn't happen. But at the same time, purpose doesn't just jump up, you know, from you're walking down that path. It doesn't just jump up out of the bushes and surprise you. You've got to get on your hands and knees and go digging around, and you've got to look for it. Purpose does not find you by accident. You have to look for it. At least that has been my experience of myself and everyone that I've helped find their purpose. We've really had to dig for it. And most people are scared of the digging. Too hard to work. Introspective work is the hardest work you will ever do in your life.
Yep.
You know, and most people just won't do it. And, you know, it's a real shame, because you're missing out on a lot of the real juice in life. Mm-hmm. Kind of is where your purpose is at.
I'm a big guy when it comes to happiness and, you know, the whole thing and finding happiness. And I actually went and studied with like one of the top happiness guys out there, and I learned a lot from that, and I'm going to ask you this question, because you've worked with a lot of people. You know, people are looking to change their lives. A lot of them aren't happy with who they are and what they're doing. Would you guess or say that they probably are unhappy because they haven't found their purpose?
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, there's a direct correlation between the distance from you and your purpose and the distance from you and your happiness. Essentially, happiness is purpose. You know, they're using a different name. But when you're on your purpose, you start to become happy, right? And I don't mean happy clappy kind of happy. You know, as in every single day you wake up with a beam of smile. The happiest people. That's the myth of happiness, though. That you know, if you found you're happy, that you should be a big beaming smile all the time, and that.
Right.
Nothing in life phases you, and it still does, but it's just the way I always describe it is that where I'm at in my life now, I still have the occasional vacation into anger and sadness and fear and so on and so forth, right? But I take far fewer of those vacations than I ever took in my life before, and when I go, I only go for the weekend. Right. Right? Yeah, no. My vacations themselves are far fewer, and I don't stay for as long. Right. And that's, you know, a lot of people have actually chosen to go and live in unhappy town, right?
Right.
And ultimately they're in that place because they've not really found their purpose. Once you find your purpose, your vacations become far less frequently. They're far less frequent. You stay far less time.
Yeah, you actually hit on the key term there, is that they chose to do that. You know, the big thing when it comes to happiness, even if you're still struggling to find your purpose, from what I found, is that you choose. You have that choice whether or not you want to do that, and that's all that it is. And once you find your purpose, it's much easier to make that choice. But what I want to tie into that with the purpose is the importance of core values. Core values and purpose, are they interrelated? Are they the same thing, or is there just a completely different segment for those?
I guess, kind of like we said, passion are kind of like way markers on the way to your purpose.
Yeah.
Your values are pretty much the same. I mean, they tie. They're inextricably linked. You can't separate your values from your purpose. But for me, when I think of my values, they're the things that get me to my purpose and make sure that I stay there. Right?
Right.
So, for example, you know, if one of my values is, you know, I told several of you guys, or I told you guys at the event, that, you know, amongst my top values are the exact ones that I sign off every signature with, and I have a tattoo over my body: truth, joy, and love. Okay, so. If my values are truth, joy, and love, and they're amongst my highest values, and I am not, you know, I'm going through life telling lots and lots of lies, and most importantly, lies to myself, that I'm not being particularly joyful, and that I feel no love in my life, either for myself or for other people, then I'm never going to be on my purpose. Because they're my indicators to let me know that I'm in the right place. So, you know, however, you know, at the same time, if my life is feeling like, you know, truth is the most prevalent kind of one of the most prevalent characters in my life, and being joyful, I'm happy more of the time than I'm not, and I'm feeling a lot of love, and I'm giving out a lot of love. Then doesn't guarantee that my purpose is absolutely present, but I'm far more likely to be there. I always find talking about absolute purpose and values quite a difficult concept, because they're so tightly, sometimes it comes out of your mouth and you are saying one and the same thing, and then other times when you describe it, you know that you're describing something slightly different.
Right.
Even for myself, I haven't come up with a real clear answer. Sometimes there've been times when I've been absolutely clear that your values are your purpose. Mm-hmm. And other times I've gone, well, no, because I can separate my values from, I know that I've got to do that, but not got to. I know that I want to be this person that, this person in my life, I'm trying to be this version of Dax Moyer, which is my purpose. But I know that I can also be off of my values at times, where I can be telling lies, where I can be hyping, where mm-hmm. I can be, less than truthful, less than joyful, less than loving, right? But that thing will still be I still feel that's my purpose, but I'm just not on it. Mm-hmm. So there is definitely a distinction between the two, although it's not a really, for me, it's even though I can be quite eloquent at times, I don't quite have the words for it just yet.
Could someone be successful in life, from business and relationships, if they really don't know their purpose? And understand their core values?
I would love to say no for simplicity's sake, but I think yes, because I think that there are people that, well, look, we kind of, I guess we have to kind of reverse engineer that question first and ask, what is success?
Yeah.
So, is the person happy? Is the person, does the person feel that their life has some form of meaning? But then again, if you feel your life has some form of meaning, then it has some form of purpose, right? So, mm-hmm. But happiness is definitely a key indicator of living a life of purpose. But it really depends on how you measure the success. So do I have $1 million in my bank account, right? So yes, I've got $1 million, but I'm on my third wife. I'm really unhealthy. I've had a coronary bypass and so on and so forth. Well, I don't think many people would measure that as success, but I would like to say that if you don't find your purpose, that you never become successful, because from a simplistic perspective, it makes the whole argument for it simple. But I've met some people who seem to be very, very happy in life. And I didn't really feel that they were pulling there wasn't a facade there. They weren't telling me lies about their happiness. They generally quite happy-go-lucky people, and yet they still hadn't found their purpose. So, if we're talking about trends, then I would definitely say you are more likely, from all the people I've met and all the people I've coached, you are far more likely to be a happier and successful person once you find your purpose. But there's always that exception to the rule, I guess. And I don't know about you, but I have met some people.
Oh yeah.
Met some people that didn't really neatly fit the category.
You think you would have been able to make it this far, or be at the level that you're at as a guru, or at least in your career, if you really didn't know what your purpose was?
I honestly don't believe I could have, because so much of what I do on a day-to-day basis, I mean, everything from the messages that I put out on Facebook, they're messages that have to tie into my core purpose. And if they don't, then I don't post them, So I find it inconceivable now that I could have kind of gotten to the place I'm at. And, I want to be really clear. I mean, I've come a long way compared to where I started. But I'm not living some super duper duper life. I live a very, very nice life. I'm not a millionaire. I earn in the multiple six figures now, but I'm not a millionaire. So it was interesting being at that event where there are several seven figure income earners there, and they were coming to me asking me for advice and asking me to be their guru. But again, that's another example about how guruism is. It's not one thing. It's not it's not just one place you arrive at. Yeah. So it's very possible for me to guru a multimillionaire mm-hmm. in an area that he's in the dark, but he can still guru me right back in an area where I'm in the dark, So,
right.
But I kind of came off topic there. The idea being that, no, I don't think I would have ended up where I'm at now if I'd have carried on being the Dax Moy that was getting, you know, really proud of himself and really proud of his accomplishments, and where vanity and arrogance and all that kind of stuff was starting to surface in. Again, though, we have to be really careful with these classifications. There are very greedy, very nasty, very arrogant people that make it to multimillionaires and even billionaires. You know, they make it, so they still manage to break the rules. So, you know, and I, again, because one of my core values is truth, I don't want to be involved in telling the lie that, you know, you can never make it good without being a good person, because you can, but it depends upon what you know. I also know that some of those people that go through life treating each other like shit, and often generally tend to not appreciate the stuff that they've got as well. But you know, from an outward perspective, looking in, they can often look like they're extremely successful and they haven't been nice people. So,
right. Okay.
But I really don't believe I'd have gotten to this place without the kind of the guru concepts that I'm trying to live my life to at the moment.
Cool. A few more questions for you. We were talking about before how stories, you know, that's what helps to resonate people, the struggles. That's what helps connect with people. Throughout your career, what you're doing, what's been one of the most challenging things, let's say career-wise, that you've had to handle or had to go through where you weren't sure things were going to work out, but then they actually ended up being okay?
Career-wise, I mean, and it's still the same problem to this day, in fact. I mean, I've gotten it mostly right, but career-wise, it's always been staffing, right? It's always been trying to get the guys to, you know, I'm very clear on my vision, and when I recruit people, I often believe that I'm recruiting people who are very, very strongly in alignment with me, that, you know, they say all the right things at the interviews and the assessments and everything else. And very often you find that actually after a short space of time into the business, they're not really in alignment with you, but that you may have given them too much power now, because you've now built them up to 20, 30 appointments a week, and you don't want, you know, oh, damn, if I sack this person, then I'm potentially losing out on all this income, right? So the greed monster raises its ugly head. And that's, in the past, that was something that I really struggled with. So I ended up keeping, I hired too fast and fired too slow. Now I'm a lot more selective of how you become a coach with me, and I'm also much faster to fire. But I still, you know, it's the area I've struggled the most with. Most people don't have the same level of passion that I have as a coach. I live and breathe this stuff. You know, I kind of, it's what, you know, it's a big part of what my life is about. Most people that I come into contact with they like it. They like it very much, and they use words like passion and purpose, but the proof is in the pudding, and they generally tend to want the easy life. They very often, they think that by aligning with me somehow, because I've been successful, that they'll be able to reap a lot of the benefits of kind of what I've been able to accomplish for myself, but without realizing that they have to be as diligent in their approach to it as I have been. Okay. So I have found that really difficult. I also wear my heart on my sleeve a fair bit as well. And, you know, I've felt over the years very let down by certain people who've come to work with me, who've left and having poached lots of clients and moved on to set up their own businesses and stuff. And, you know, and that took a long time to kind of grow up and mature enough to just kind of let that sort of stuff go. But those have been, you know, there was a point where at one point six of my staff, you know, they got together all at one point and they all left and taking 60% of my client base with them to open another studio. And that hurt on lots of different levels, and it, you know, hurt financially, and those kind of things. So I've been to the point where, you know, I was earning lots of money. I've been all the way back down again to basically taking out my own savings to keep my business running. So money I'd already earned, and I was having to pour it back in just to keep it going because of staffing issues. And then, you know, and it's ebbed and flowed. And that's a big lesson I've learned about life. It's just to, you know, people say go with the flow. Well, you know, it ebbs and flows. You do have to kind of, you'd have to ride it through. We just had the quietest quarter in the last 6 year history of my company. We're really, really quiet. And one of my staff left us pretty much as a result of that, because he was his first PT job, and he was quite scared. And, well, is this what it's like all the time? to me, I'm just like, well, you know, that's how it goes. And you, once you've seen the cycle a few times, and you know that sometimes you're counting diamonds, and other times you're picking fluff out of the corners of your pockets and putting your hand down the back of the sofa. You know, it's just how it goes. And I've grown up enough to know that very often people just entering the profession don't know that, and they fall for all this recession crap, and you know, there's no money to be earned and all the rest of it. I know there is, and I know that, but I know that life just ebbs and flows, and sometimes things work really well for you, other times they don't. Just go with it.
Yeah, and I mean, we've actually dived into a ton of really heavy stuff, a lot of things that people don't cover when we talk about marketing and business. You've learned a lot of this from experience, these kinds of things, but is there any people that you actually are learning from that have helped you in this process, or tools or resources that you've used to kind of help get you there?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I mean, I mentored under Joe Vitale from The Secret. I mentored under Bob Proctor. I bought everything that Dan Kennedy wrote for a while. And I'm not knocking Dan Kennedy at all, because I think he's a fantastic marketer. But I found the Dan Kennedy journey took me into being the person I didn't want to be. That was largely responsible for me losing myself, in fact, because you know, I started to become this marketer guy, and the guy who was, well, if you don't, you know, you don't like it my way, then screw you, kind of thing. But I still learned a lot from him, and I still use Kennedy techniques now, but I use them with a Dax Moy slant that feels more wholesome and good. Mark Joyner's stuff I absolutely loved. One of the best business minds that I've come across over the years has been Jay Abraham. He's fantastic. And certainly for a period, Jay Abraham was very much like Dan Kennedy, is very cutthroat and your competition. And he's had a bit of a spiritual awakening in the last 3-4 years or so, and he's got a much softer side to him and a much, much more kind of abundance mindset. And I like the journey that he's been on. So he's been pretty cool. All of Seth Godin's stuff, absolutely love. Not because, I guess it's a strange thing with Seth Godin's stuff, is that it's extremely deep whilst at the same time feeling like it's quite superficial at first. You know, it's very, these short messages, these little snippets, you know, think of this. And yet some of those books have had very, very profound impact upon my business. Little ideas from things like Linchpin and Tribes, and you know, a lot of this guruism and this guru stuff can find certain elements of it. Indeed, can find their roots back to concepts like Tribes and Linchpin. It's just my slant on some of the stuff that he said there. Other people that I really like. Brendan Burchard's kind of, he's done some really interesting stuff. And again, so his falls very much in alignment with the guru concepts as well. I can't remember what Burchard calls it. Millionaire messenger.
Yeah,
so, you know, he sets people up in along that line. It's a very, very similar concept. Max Simon, kind of a bit of an underdog guy that most people have never come across, but he's a spiritual marketer, funnily enough. You know, it's kind of, he's everything he sells is to do with spirituality, but he does his marketing in a very genuine, down to earth way that some people find a bit too fluffy around the edges. But I just really love him for he is actually just being who he is, and he's attracting ultimately, I mean, this is the core message of marketing. It's the one that I like to share most of all. The person that I did a coaching call with before this. I went down through his Facebook wall and I went through his website, and it became really, really obvious that he wasn't present on either of them. It was all the messages were from other people, and the kind of the concepts were other people's concepts, but he himself hadn't shown up for work. You know, he wasn't present on his own Facebook wall, really. It was comments and quotes from lots of other people. The number one key to, I think, becoming a successful marketer, and correlating this along with the guru concepts, is be present in everything you do. If you read something, if you've written a blog post, then can you say, like, would you be able to differentiate that blog post from Dax Moy or Mike Geary or Craig Ballantyne or anyone? Or, you know, are we all just saying the same shit, right? Are we saying the same stuff in from a contextual perspective and from a base content perspective, but is the spin that you're putting on it, and I mean spin in a good terms, not a kind of a political parlance, but is the way that is Eric Rokic's version of what's being said enough to make it sound like him and that he's, you know, he's making a difference, or are we just adding to the noise? And I think a lot of what goes out there just generally tends to add to the noise because we're all kind of saying what he said.
Yeah,
right?
Most
marketing is the equivalent of what he said, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so you can really stand out in the marketplace by just being you. And for some people, you know, one of my students who's done really, really well for himself, a guy called Paul Mort, yeah. He, you know, he swears in his posts and, you know, but that's just because the reason he does it is not just to be profane, but because that's who he is. That's how he, you know, every other word out of his mouth in a normal conversation with him would include a swear word, right? So
yeah, it does.
Why would he? But he tried for so long to be a different person when he was writing because all the marketing material said that he was supposed, oh, well, that's not very professional. Don't be that guy.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, there are people that have absolutely fallen in love with him because that's who he is. Now, you know, every now and then a little swear escapes my lips, but it's, you know, and I do swear, I do curse, but if I were to try and say, oh, but it's really worked well for Paul, and I were to do what Paul does, I would come across as fake.
Yeah.
No, well, who, you know, and my message would get lost because, well, this isn't the Dax Moy that we know. That doesn't make sense to us.
Yeah.
So the truth is we've all got to find our own voices.
Yeah.
We've got to say, who am I? Like, one of my rules for all of my marketing material and for, you know, for every message I put out there is that it should sound exactly the same way as it would sound if you met me face to face. And so I'm very proud of that people meet me all the time and they say, oh, you sound just like your blog posts. They may never have ever heard my voice ever. And yet I sound the way I write.
Right. And that's one of the hardest things to do, though, but it's very important.
It is. But it's what we need to do. It's what we need to practice. And you need to read your own material when you put it out and say, does that sound like me, or does that sound like I've just written something for my, you know, my kind of sixth grade English teacher? You know,
right.
Who am I writing for here? You've got to, and not just the style of writing, but the message itself. Is that something that I really and truly believe? Or, you know, like an example that I gave at the event was that, you know, when there's affiliate sales going on, everyone seems to get out their my good friend emails, right?
Yeah.
And you know, my good, and these people are my good friends that I've never met before, but have said to me, Dax, if you promote my product, I'll give you 50% affiliate commission. Well, you know, I don't judge anyone who chooses to do that, but I just question whether they're doing themselves harm in the long term, because the whole my good friend thing is, you know that you're not being honest. And if you know you're not being honest, you've started down the slippery slope to not being who you really are.
Yeah.
And, you know, a big part of my marketing, you know, I don't want to sound holier than thou. You know, I do a lot of things to make money. I think out ahead of time and say, right, what's going to have the biggest impact upon this audience or upon this market? So I still do that. But at the same time, I make sure that what's going to have the biggest impact is also the thoughts and feelings that I'm still in alignment with myself.
Yeah,
and I think, you know, it's that gut check that most people aren't really and truly taking when it comes to their marketing. They don't stop. Once they've written all their email autoresponder series for something, they don't stop to say, hey, you know, is this really who I am and what I'm about? Or could I say the message in a different way, or is this a message that really needs to come from me? Because actually, I think I'm acting as a messenger for someone else's message.
Right.
We're not. I think if we were just a little bit more honest about what we're doing, we would stop doing about 80% of what we do.
that's really a good point. And what I'm going to do is we'll wrap up on that. And what I want you to just share a little bit about your Unstoppable Year program. This is pretty cool. My good friend Dax Moy here has a program.
My good friend. Right, so the program is called Unstoppable, and it's at the website myunstoppableyear.com. It's quite simply, I was about to say it's the antithesis of goal setting programs, but it's not. It runs hand in hand with it, but it's very, very different. Whereas my other program, the Magic 100, was literally about coming out of the starting blocks really fast and chasing your goals for all they're worth and, you know, going after the life with both hands, you know, and getting everything. This is a different approach. This recognizes something that I've come to recognize over the years, that it's not so much our lack of gas that stops us getting to where we want to go. It's the fact that we tend to come out the starting blocks with the brakes on, the brakes and anchors. And so my unstoppable year, it starts out with this, as its name suggests, I mean, it's a year-long coaching program. It's online-based, but it's based around the idea that we don't set goals until we release the brakes and we release the anchors. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've got my coaching group doing a whole bunch of weird and wonderful things, everything from, you know, some of the exercises include going back and reading books that you read when you were a child, like your favorite Roald Dahl novels and kind of stuff like that. It's all there for a reason, and it's all there to remove the rust and crust that's in people's mind, to kind of get them shifting off the anchors, to get them releasing the brakes, so that when it does come time for them to pursue the goals that they really want to achieve, there's nothing holding them back anymore. Their current exercise, for example, is an exercise called The House That Guilt Built, and we're looking at the guilt that people carry around in their lives that are stopping them from being able to progress. And so, and there are lots and lots of these exercises. They, you know, it's a very unusual program in that it asks people to go quite deep. Most of us, when it comes to pursuing our goals, we stay quite superficial. This program asks you to go quite deep. It asks you for the truth. And it asks you, it's not something you have to share with me or anyone else, but it asks you to tell yourself the truth. And that's the work that most people are not prepared to do most of the time. But absolutely, those that are making massive inroads into changing their life. We're only 5 weeks into the program, and there's people giving me back reports of just very dramatic change already. So yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting program, one that's extremely dear to my heart, because all I'm doing is I'm sharing exactly how I coach my one-to-one clients through their sticking points.
Yeah.
And so it's exactly the same exercises. It's just that you don't have me in the same room as you.
And where can they find that if someone's interested and they want to look into it?
It's at myunstoppableyear.com.
Okay. And if people wanted to learn a little bit more about you or check anything else out, is there any other sites that they can visit?
Yeah. I mean, I have this, the Dax Moy community. We've got about 10,000 people in it. It's a free place. It's daxmoy.ning.com.
Okay.
I'm currently just right now, I'm having a, because most of my sites are geared towards something specific, like there, mm-hmm. you know, there's Personal Trainer Success Academy, which is about personal trainer success, of course.
Right.
Then there's my other sites are about my personal training business, and my other sites are about some of my products. I'm just at the moment, my new site is just being built. It'll be up within the next week or two. It's called iamdaxmoy.com. And that'll be a place where I just go on and release my mad ramblings and talk to you about whatever is on my mind that may not be fitness industry specific or may not be goal achievement specific, but it'll give you much more of an insight into who Dax Moy is and what he's about and what his values are and how crazy he is.
Very cool. Dax, I really appreciate the time you're coming on. We dove into topics that really no one's covering, especially when it comes into this industry. That's very, very important when it comes to being happy, knowing purpose, being successful for whatever your definition of success is. So I really appreciate the time coming on, and I look forward to talking to you soon.
No, thank you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the platform for the ramblings again.
Anytime, man. Take care.
You've just listened to an exclusive interview on fitnessbusinessinterviews.com. If you're looking to take your business to the next level, or you're looking for more interviews and secret insider tips, then visit www.fitnessbusinessinterviews.com.